This is Audible.
Random House Audiobooks presents Memoirs of a Geisha by Arthur Golden. Read for you by Elena Erica Davis.
Memoirs of a Geisha. Suppose that you and I were sitting in a quiet room overlooking a garden, chatting and sipping at our cups of green tea while we talked about something that had happened a long while ago, and I said to you, "That afternoon when I met so-and-so was the very best afternoon of my life, and also the very worst afternoon." I expect you might put down your teacup and say, "Well, now, which was it? Was it the best or the worst? Because it can't possibly have been both." Ordinarily, I'd have to laugh at myself and agree with you. But the truth is that the afternoon when I met Mr. Tanaka Ichiro really was the best and the worst of my life. If I had never known him, I'm sure I would not have become a geisha. I wasn't born and raised to be a Kyoto geisha. I wasn't even born in Kyoto. I'm a fisherman's daughter from a little town called Yoroido on the Sea of Japan. In our little fishing village, I lived in what I called a tipsy house. It stood near a cliff where the wind off the ocean was always blowing. Inside this tipsy house, I lived something of a lopsided life, because from my earliest years I was very much like my mother and hardly at all like my father or older sister Satsu. My mother said it was because we were made just the same, she and I. And it was true, we both had the same peculiar eyes of a sort you almost never see in Japan. Instead of being dark brown like everyone else's, my mother's eyes were a translucent gray, and mine are just the same. My mother always said she'd married my father because she had too much water in her personality, and he had too much wood in his. People who knew my father understood right away what she was talking about. Water flows from place to place quickly and always finds a crack to spill through. Wood, on the other hand, holds fast to the earth. In my father's case, this was a good thing, for he was a fisherman, and a man with wood in his personality is at ease on the sea. When he wasn't fishing, he sat at the little table in our dark front room mending a fishing net. His face was very heavily creased, and into each crease he had tucked some worry or other, so that it wasn't really his own face any longer, but more like a tree that had nests of birds in all the branches. Our parents might have had other children besides Satsu and me, particularly since my father hoped for a boy to fish with him. But when I was 7, my mother grew terribly ill with what was probably bone cancer, though at the time I had no idea what was wrong. Her only escape from discomfort was to sleep, which she began to do the way a cat does, which is to say, more or less constantly. Then one afternoon, I was sitting on the pitted floor of our dark front room singing to a cricket I'd found that morning, when a voice called out at the door, "Oi! Open up! It's Dr. Miura!" Dr. Miura came to our fishing village once a week and had made a point of walking up the hill to check on my mother ever since her illness began. My father was at home that day because a terrible storm was coming. When I opened the door for him, Dr. Miura slipped out of his shoes and stepped right past me into the house. My father and the doctor went into the other room where my mother lay sleeping. I tried to listen at the door, but I could hear only my mother groaning and nothing of what they said. I occupied myself with making tea, and soon the doctor came back out, rubbing his hands together and looking very stern. He and my father sat together at the table. "You need to have a talk with one of the women in the village," Dr. Miura began. "Mrs. Sugi, perhaps. Ask her to make a nice new robe for your wife."
"I haven't the money, doctor," my father said.
"We've all grown poorer lately, but you owe it to your wife. She shouldn't die in that tattered robe she's wearing."
So she's going to die soon. A few more weeks, perhaps. She's in terrible pain. Death will release her. After this, I couldn't hear the voices any longer, for in my ears I heard a sound like a bird's wings flapping in panic. Perhaps it was my heart, I don't know. After Dr. Mura left, my father went on sitting for a long while in silence with his back to me. At last he said my name in a whisper. I went and knelt beside him. Go down to the village. Bring back some incense for the altar. Our tiny Buddhist altar rested on an old crate beside the entrance to the kitchen and was the only thing of value in our tipsy house. But father, wasn't there anything else? He made a gesture with his hand that meant for me to leave. The path from our tipsy house followed the edge of the sea cliffs before turning inland toward the village. Walking it on a day like this was difficult, but I remember feeling grateful that the fierce wind drew my mind from the things troubling me. I ran down the path until the village came into view below me. Yoroido had only one road leading right to the front door of the Japan Coastal Seafood Company. It was lined with a number of houses whose front rooms were used for shops. I ran across the street toward the Okada house where dry goods were sold, but then something happened to me. One of those trivial things with huge consequences, like losing your step and falling in front of a train. The packed dirt road was slippery in the rain, and my feet went out from under me. I fell forward onto one side of my face. I have only a vague idea what happened next. I heard voices and felt myself turned onto my back. I was lifted and carried. I could tell they were taking me into the Japan Coastal Seafood Company because I smelled the odor of fish wrapping itself all around me. I knew I was wet from the rain and bloody too, and that I was barefoot and dirty and wearing peasant's clothing. It was in this condition I found myself looking up into the face of Mr. Tanaka Ichiro. I'd seen Mr. Tanaka in our village many times before. He lived in a much larger town nearby but came every day, for his family owned the Japan Coastal Seafood Company. He didn't wear peasant clothing like the fishermen, but rather a man's kimono with kimono trousers. I lay there on that slimy table while Mr. Tanaka examined my lip, pulling it down with his fingers and tipping my head this way and that. All at once, he caught sight of my gray eyes, which were fixed on his face with such fascination I couldn't pretend I hadn't been staring at him. "I know you," he said. "You're old Sakamoto's little girl." Then Mr. Tanaka told his assistant, who was named Sugi, to go and fetch Dr. Miura. I told Mr. Tanaka the doctor had been at our house a few minutes earlier. "Where is your house?" Mr. Tanaka asked. "It's the little tipsy house up on the cliffs." "Well, Sugi, walk up toward Sakamoto's tipsy house and look for Dr. Miura." I imagined Mr. Tanaka would go back to his work after Sugi had left, but instead he stood near the table a long while looking at me. "Dr. Miura told me your mother is sick," he said. "With your father so old, what will become of you? Who takes care of you even now?"
"I suppose I take care of myself these days," I said.
"I know a certain man. He's older now, but when he was a boy about your age, his father died. The very next year his mother died, and then his older brother ran away to Osaka and left him alone. Sounds a bit like you, don't you think?" Mr. Tanaka said. "Well, that man's name is Tanaka Ichiro," he went on. "Yes, me. I was taken in by the Tanaka family at the age of 12. After I got a bit older, I was married to the daughter and adopted. Now I help run the family's seafood company. So things turned out all right for me in the end, you see. Perhaps something like that might happen to you, too."
From that very moment on, I began to have fantasies that Mr. Tanaka would adopt me. A week or so later, when my fantasies of adoption had had plenty of time to ripen, I came home one afternoon to find Mr. Tanaka sitting across from my father at the little table in our house. I knew they were talking about something serious because they didn't even notice me when I stepped into our entryway. I froze there to listen to them.
So, Sakamoto, what do you think of my proposal?
I don't know, sir, said my father. I can't picture the girls living anywhere else.
I understand, but they'd be much better off, and so would you. Just see to it they come down to the village tomorrow afternoon.
The next day, in preparation for meeting Mr. Tanaka in the village, I scrubbed my dirty ankles and soaked for a while in the bath. I sat a long while looking out to sea and feeling very independent, for I was about to see something of the world outside our little village for the first time in my life. When Satsu and I reached the Japan Coastal Seafood Company, we watched the fishermen unloading their catches at the pier. At length, Mr. Tanaka called us inside and led us down a long corridor. Down at the end was an office, lovely to my 9-year-old eyes. Inside the doorway, Satsu and I stood in our bare feet on a slimy floor of stone. Before us, a step led up to a platform covered with tatami mats. On the platform sat an old woman on a cushion who rose when she saw us and came down to the edge to arrange herself on her knees. She was old and cranky-looking, and I don't think you could ever meet anyone who fidgeted more. Mr. Tanaka said to her, "This is Chio-chan, and her older sister Satsu-san." The old woman reached out and patted me with her fingers.
"This one's rather pretty, isn't she? Such unusual eyes, and you can see that she's clever."
She got to her feet and gave Mr. Tanaka a look he seemed to understand at once, because he left the room closing the door behind him. Mrs. Fidget untied the peasant shirt Satsu was wearing and removed it. She moved Satsu's bosoms around a bit, looked under her arms, and then turned her around and looked at her back. Then, as if she hadn't done enough already, Mrs. Fidget yanked Satsu's pants to the floor, looked her up and down, and turned her around facing front again. Then she took her by the shoulders and seated her on the platform. She put her hands on Satsu's knees and spread them apart, and without a moment's hesitation, she reached her hand between Satsu's legs. Next, Mrs. Fidget came straight at me, and in a moment my own pants were down around my knees, and my shirt was taken off just as Satsu's had been. She put a finger between my legs and gave what felt to me like a pinch, in such a way that I cried out.
"The girls are healthy,"
she said to Mr. Tanaka when he came back into the room, "and very suitable. Both of them are intact. The older one has far too much wood, but the younger one has a good deal of water. Pretty, too, don't you think?"
"I'm sure they're both attractive girls in their way," he said. "Why don't we talk about it while I walk you out? The girls will wait here for me."
When Mr. Tanaka had closed the door behind them, I turned to see Satsu sitting on the edge of the platform.
"Who was that horrible woman?" she said to me. "Why should she look at us in that horrible way?"
"Satsu-san, don't you understand?" I said. "Mr. Tanaka is planning to adopt us."
"What are you talking about?" she said. "Mr. Tanaka can't adopt us."
"Father is old, and now that our mother is sick, I think Mr. Tanaka is worried about our future. There won't be anyone to take care of us." Satsu stood. She was so agitated to hear this. In a moment, her eyes had begun to squint, and I could see she was hard at work willing herself to believe that nothing was going to take us from our tipsy home. One morning during the heat of the summer, I was on my way back from fetching a packet of tea in the village when I heard a crunching noise behind me. It turned out to be Mr. Sugi, Mr. Tanaka's assistant, running up the path. Mr. Tanaka wants you and your sister to come down to the village as soon as you can." I ran up to the house and found my father sitting at the table, digging grime out of a rut in the wood with one of his fingernails. Satsu was putting slivers of charcoal into the stove. It seemed as though the two of them were waiting for something horrible to happen. I said, "Father, Mr. Tanaka wants Satsu-san and me to go down to the village." Satsu took off her apron, hung it on a peg, and walked out the door. My father didn't answer but blinked a few times, staring at the point where Satsu had been. Then he turned his eyes heavily toward the floor and gave a nod. I heard my mother cry out in sleep from the back room. Satsu was almost to the village before I caught up with her. I'd imagined this day for weeks already, but I'd never expected to feel as frightened as I did. Outside the Japan Coastal Seafood Company, I bowed and said good morning to Mr. Tanaka, expecting he would be happy to see us. Instead, he was strangely cold. I suppose this should have been my first clue that things weren't going to happen just the way I'd imagined. He led us to a horse-drawn wagon and said, "Mr. Sugi will be riding in the front with me, so you had better get into the back." During the trip, Satsu and I didn't speak a word until we topped the hill overlooking the town of Senzuru, when all of a sudden she said, "A train!" I looked out to see a train making its way toward the town. The wagon came to a stop a few minutes later on a patch of dirt beside the train tracks just outside the town. A crowd of people stood with sacks and crates piled around them, and there to one side of them was Mrs. Fidget standing beside a peculiarly narrow man wearing a stiff kimono. Mr. Tanaka introduced us to this man whose name was Bekku. Mr. Bekku said nothing at all but only looked closely at me and seemed puzzled by Satsu. Soon the train had come to a stop before us. Mr. Bekku, in his stiff kimono, wedged himself between Satsu and me and led us by our elbows into the train car. I heard Mr. Tanaka say something, but I was too confused and upset to understand it. When I peered out the window, I saw Mr. Tanaka walking back toward his cart and Mrs. Fidget wiping her hands all over her kimono. After a moment, my sister said, "Chio-chan, do you know where we're going?" I think all she wanted was a yes or no answer. Probably it didn't matter to her what our destination was, so long as someone knew what was happening. But of course, I didn't. I asked the narrow man, Mr. Bekku. "Kyoto," he answered. I felt so sick with worry at hearing this. I couldn't bring myself to look Satsu in the eye any longer. For all I knew, they ground up children in Kyoto and fed them to dogs. We were on that train for many hours without food to eat. By the time we arrived, as evening was approaching, I felt as sore as a rock must feel when the waterfall has pounded on it all day long. Back then, around 1930, a fair number of rickshaws still operated in Kyoto. We climbed into one with Mr. Bekku squeezed tightly on the bench between us. After a block or two, I worked up my courage and said to Mr. Bekku, "Won't you please tell us where we're going?" He didn't look as if he would reply, but after a moment he said, "To your new home." At length, the rickshaw turned down an alleyway of wooden houses. I watched women in kimono rushing around in a great hurry on the little street. They looked very elegant to me, though as I later learned, they were mostly maids. When we came to a halt before a doorway, Mr. Bekku instructed me to get out. He climbed out behind me, and then as if the day hadn't been difficult enough, the worst thing of all happened, for when Satsu tried to get out as well, Mr. Bekku turned and pushed her back with his long arm. "Stay there," he said to her. "You're going elsewhere." I felt myself being dragged backwards by Mr. Bekku. I heard women's voices and quite a bit of commotion. I was on the point of throwing myself onto the street
when suddenly Satsu's mouth fell open at something she saw in the doorway behind me. I was in a narrow entryway with an ancient-looking well on one side and a few plants on the other. Mr. Beku had dragged me inside and now he pulled me up onto my feet. There, on the step of the entryway, just slipping her feet into her lacquered zori, stood an exquisitely beautiful woman wearing a kimono lovelier than anything I'd ever imagined. Her gown was woven of pure silk, and so was the obi, or sash, embroidered in pale greens and yellows. And her clothing wasn't the only extraordinary thing about her. Her face was painted a kind of rich white, like the wall of a cloud when lit by the sun. This was my first glimpse of Hatsumomo. At the time, she was one of the most renowned geisha in the district of Gion, though of course I didn't know any of this then. She was smiling at me, though not in a kindly way, and then she said,
"Mr. Beku, could you take out the garbage later? I'd like to be on my way."
There was no garbage in the entryway. She was talking about me. Suddenly, an older woman, tall and knobby like a bamboo pole, appeared in the doorway behind her.
"I don't know how anyone puts up with you, Hatsumomo-san," said the woman. But she did gesture for Mr. Beku to pull me onto the street again, which he did. After this, Hatsumomo walked away, and then Mr. Beku handed me over to the older woman in the entryway. He climbed back into the rickshaw with my sister, and the driver raised the poles. But I never saw them leave because I slumped down in the entryway in tears. The older woman must have taken pity on me.
"Now, now, little girl. There's no need to worry so. No one's going to cook you."
She told me to call her auntie, and then she looked down at me square in the face and said in a throaty voice,
"Heavens! What startling eyes! You're a lovely girl, aren't you? Mother will be thrilled."
Auntie led me through the doorway, where I found myself standing on a dirt corridor leading between two structures to a courtyard in the back. One was a little dwelling like my house in Yoroido, two rooms with floors of dirt. It turned out to be the maid's quarters. On the other side of the corridor, a small, elegant house sat up on foundation stones in such a way that a cat might have crawled underneath it. The corridor passing between them opened onto the dark sky above, which gave me the feeling I was standing in something more like a miniature village than a house. Auntie had disappeared into the kitchen and was talking in a hoarse voice to somebody. At length, the somebody came out. She turned out to be a girl about my age, carrying a wooden bucket. Her body was narrow, but her face was plump and almost perfectly round, so that she looked to me like a melon on a stick. Within a few days, I'd given her the nickname of Pumpkin, which everyone came to call her, even her customers many years later when she was a geisha in Gion. Just then, Auntie came out from the kitchen and shooed Pumpkin away.
"May I ask, ma'am, what is this place?" I asked her.
"It's an okia," she said. "It's where geisha live. If you work very hard, you'll grow up to be a geisha yourself. But you won't make it as far as next week unless you listen to me very closely, because Mother and Granny are coming down the stairs in just a moment to look at you. The older one, the one we call Granny, has never liked anyone in her life, so don't worry what she says. The one you want to impress is Mother. She's not a bad sort, but she cares about only one thing."
I didn't have a chance to find out what the one thing was, for I heard a creaking noise from the direction of the front entrance hall, and in a moment the two women came drifting out onto the walkway.
"This is the new girl, Mother," Auntie said, and gave me a little shove. Then I heard a raspy voice. "Get up and come closer. I want to have a look at you," the one called Mother said.
I felt certain she was going to say something more to me after I'd approached her, but instead she took out from her obi, where she kept it tucked,
a pipe with a metal bowl and a long stem made of bamboo. She put the pipe into her mouth and lit it with a match from a tiny metal box. Now she took a close look at me for the first time, puffing on her pipe while the old woman beside her sighed. Mother was a hideous-looking woman, though much younger than Auntie, which I hadn't expected. It turned out that Mother was actually Auntie's younger sister, though they called one another Mother and Auntie, just as everyone else in the Orkia did. Actually, they weren't really sisters in the way Satsu and I were. They hadn't been born into the same family, but Granny had adopted them both. I took the opportunity to steal a glance at Granny. Whereas Mother was a bit on the plump side, with stubby fingers and a fat neck, Granny was old and shriveled. "She's rather pretty, don't you think?" Mother said.
"There are too many pretty girls in Gion," said Granny. "What we need is a smart girl, not a pretty girl. That Hatsumomo is as pretty as they come, and look at what a fool she is."
After this, Granny stood with Auntie's help and made her way back up the walkway. Soon I heard the sound of a door in the front entrance hall sliding open and then shut again, and Auntie came back.
"Well, little girl," Mother told me, "you're in Kyoto now. You're going to have to learn to behave or you'll get a beating. My advice to you is, work very hard and never leave the Orkia without permission. Do as you're told and don't be too much trouble. And you might begin learning the art of a geisha 2 or 3 months from now. I didn't bring you here to be a maid. I'll throw you out if it comes to that."
Mother puffed on her pipe and kept her eyes fixed on me. I found myself wondering if my sister was standing before some other cruel woman in another house somewhere in this horrible city. And I had a sudden image in my mind of my poor, sick mother, propping herself on one elbow on her futon, and looking around to see where we had gone. During those first few days in that strange place, I don't think I could have felt worse if I'd lost my arms and legs rather than my family and my home. Mother had told me I could begin my training within a few months if I worked hard and behaved myself. As I learned from Pumpkin, beginning my training meant going to school in another section of Gion to take lessons in things like music, dance, and tea ceremony. All the girls studying to be geisha took classes at this same school. I felt sure I'd find Satsu there when I was finally permitted to go, so by the end of my first week, I'd made up my mind to be as obedient as a cow following along on a rope, in the hopes that Mother would send me to the school right away. Most of my chores were straightforward. I stowed away the futons in the morning, cleaned the rooms, swept the dirt corridor, and so forth. One day after I'd been in the Orkia about 3 weeks, I went upstairs to straighten Hatsumomo's room much later than usual. I was terrified of her, even though I hardly saw her because of the busy life she led. Just as I was straightening the wood frame on which she'd hung her kimono, the door slid open all at once and I turned to see Hatsumomo standing there.
"Oh, it's you," she said. "Are you the one who keeps rearranging all my makeup jars? Why do you insist on doing that?"
"I'm very sorry, ma'am," I said. "I only move them to dust underneath."
"But if you touch them," she said, "they'll start to smell like you. And then the men will say to me, 'Hatsumomo-san, why do you stink like an ignorant girl from a fishing village? I can't see why you girls from fishing villages smell so badly. That ugly sister of yours was here looking for you the other day, and her stench was nearly as bad as yours.'"
I'd kept my eyes to the floor until then, but when I heard these words, I looked Hatsumomo right in the face to see whether or not she was telling me the truth.
"You look so surprised," she said to me. "Didn't I mention that she came here? She wanted me to give you a message about where she's living. Probably she wants you to go find her so the two of you can run away together."
"Hatsumomo-san, you want me to tell you where she is?
Well, you're going to have to earn the information. When I think how, I'll tell you. Now get out.
I didn't dare disobey her, but just before leaving the room, I stopped thinking perhaps I could persuade her. Hatsumomo-san, I know you don't like me, I said. If you would be kind enough to tell me what I want to know, I promise never to bother you again. Hatsumomo looked very pleased when she heard this and came walking toward me with a luminous happiness on her face. I thought she was going to come whisper in my ear, but she drew back her hand and slapped me.
I told you to get out of my room, didn't I? She said.
I was too stunned to know how to react, but I must have stumbled out of the room because the next thing I knew, I was sitting on the wood floor of the hallway holding my hand to my face. In a moment, Mother's door slid open.
Hatsumomo! Mother said and came to help me to my feet. What have you done to Chiyo?
She was talking about running away, Mother. I decided it would be best if I slapped her for you.
Mother summoned a maid and asked for several slices of fresh ginger, then took me into her room and seated me at the table.
Now you listen to me, little girl. I don't think you understand your job here in the Okiya. We all of us think of only one thing, how we can help Hatsumomo be successful as a geisha, even Granny. If someone as senior as Granny works hard all day to make Hatsumomo's job easier, think how much harder you have to work.
Yes, Mother. I'll continue working very hard, but before I go, may I ask, I've been wondering if anyone might know where my sister is. You see, I'd hoped to send a note to her.
Why on earth should I tell you such a thing? She said.
After this, she gave her a coughing laugh before waving her hand at me to say that I should leave the room. About a month after I'd arrived in the Okiya, Mother told me the time had come to begin my schooling. I was to accompany Pumpkin the following morning to be introduced to the teachers. That day, I awoke even earlier than usual and dressed for the first time in the blue and white robe students wore. When we set out, Pumpkin began at once to walk so fast I could hardly keep up with her. Considering that she and I were the same age and in the same peculiar position in life, I'm sure we would have talked together often if we could have. But our chores kept us so busy we hardly had time even for meals. I knew that Pumpkin had come only 6 months before me, but I knew very little else about her, so I asked.
Pumpkin, are you from Kyoto?
I was born in Sapporo, but then my mother died when I was 5, and my father sent me here to live with an uncle. Last year my uncle lost his business, and here I am.
Why don't you run away to Sapporo again?
My father had a curse put on him and died last year. I can't run away. I don't have anywhere to go.
When I find my sister, I said, you can come with us. We'll run away together.
My uncle was a very nice man, she said. Here's the last thing I heard him say before he sent me away. Some girls are smart, and some girls are stupid, he told me. You're a nice girl, but you're one of the stupid ones. You won't make it on your own in the world. I'm sending you to a place where people will tell you what to do. Do what they say, and you'll always be taken care of. So if you want to go out on your own, Chiyo-chan, you go. But me? I've found a place to spend my life. I'll work as hard as I have to so they don't send me away. But I'd sooner throw myself off a cliff than spoil my chances to be a geisha like Hatsumomo.
Whatever any of us may have thought about Hatsumomo, she was like an empress in our Okiya since she earned the income by which we all lived. And being an empress, she would have been very displeased upon returning late at night to find her palace dark with all the servants asleep. The job of waiting up to bow and welcome the geisha home almost always fell to the most junior of the cocoons, as the young geisha in training were often called. And from the moment I began taking lessons at the school, the most junior cocoon in our Okiya was me. One night,
Just as I was coming back from taking a drink of water at the well in the courtyard, I heard the outside door roll open and slam against the doorframe with a bang.
"Really, Hatsumomo-san," said a deep voice. "You'll wake everyone."
I hurried into my position on my knees, and in a moment, Hatsumomo was in the formal entrance hall, holding two packages wrapped in linen paper. Soon, another geisha stepped in behind her.
"This is our foolish lower maid," said Hatsumomo. "She has a name, I think, but why don't you just call her Little Miss Stupid?"
"Well, Little Miss Stupid," said the other geisha who was named Corinne, "go and get your big sister and me something to drink, why don't you?"
Hatsumomo had just set her packages down onto the walkway and was about to open one of them.
"Oh, be quiet, Corinne," she said. "You don't need more to drink. Just look at this, because you're going to die from happiness when you see it."
And here Hatsumomo untied the strings holding the linen paper shut and spread out upon the walkway an exquisite kimono in different powdery shades of green. I decided the time had come to excuse myself, but Hatsumomo said, "Don't go away, Little Miss Stupid." And then she turned to her friend again and told her,
"It's time for some fun, Corinne-san. Guess whose kimono this is?"
"I wish it belonged to me."
"Well, it doesn't. It belongs to none other than the geisha that we both hate worse than anyone else on earth, Miss Perfect."
"Mameha! Oh, my goodness, it is Mameha's kimono. How did you manage to get your hands on it?"
"A few days ago, I left something at the Kaburenjo Theater during a rehearsal," Hatsumomo said. "And when I went back to look for it, I heard what I thought was moaning coming up from the basement stairs. And when I crept down and turned on the light, guess who was lying there like two pieces of rice stuck together on the floor?"
"I can't believe it. Mameha."
"Don't be a fool. It was her maid and the custodian of the theater. I knew she'd do anything I wanted to keep me from telling, so I went to her later and told her I wanted this kimono of Mameha's."
Hatsumomo went to her room to fetch an inkstone and a stick of ink, as well as a brush for calligraphy. She dribbled some water from the well onto her inkstone and sat on the walkway grinding ink. When it was good and black, she dipped a brush in it and smoothed its tip against the stone so that all the ink was absorbed in the brush and none of it would drip. Then she put it into my hand and held my hand over the lovely kimono and said to me,
"Practice your calligraphy, little Chio."
This kimono, belonging to the geisha named Mameha, whom I'd never heard of at the time, was a work of art.
"I can't do it, Hatsumomo-san," I cried.
"What a shame, little sweetheart," her friend said to me, "because if you make Hatsumomo tell you again, you'll lose the chance to find your sister."
"Oh, shut up, Corinne. Chio knows she has to do what I tell her. Write something on the fabric, Miss Stupid. I don't care what it is."
When the brush first touched the kimono, Corinne was so excited she let out a squeal that woke one of the elderly maids who leaned out into the corridor. Corinne wasn't happy with the few uncertain strokes I'd made on the powdery green silk, so Hatsumomo instructed me where to mark the fabric and what sorts of marks to make. Afterward, she refolded the kimono in its wrapping of linen and tied the strings shut again. When she rolled open the door to the street, she told me to follow.
"Hatsumomo-san, if I leave the okiya without permission, Mother will be very angry and..."
"I'm giving you permission," Hatsumomo interrupted. "We have to return the kimono, don't we?"
So I could do nothing but step into my shoes and follow her. Shortly, Hatsumomo and Corinne came to a stop before a wooden door.
"You're going to take this kimono up the stairs and give it to the maid there," Hatsumomo said to me. "We'll be down here watching you."
On the landing at the top of the stairs, I knelt in the black darkness and called out,
"Excuse me, please."
"Just a moment,"
I heard a muffled voice say, and soon the door rolled open. The girl kneeling on the other side was no older than Satsu, but thin and nervous as a bird. I handed her the kimono in its wrapping of linen paper. She was very surprised and took it from me almost desperately.
"Who's there, Asami-san?" called a voice from inside the apartment.
The maid didn't answer, but opened the wrapping around the kimono as quietly as she could and tipped it this way and that to catch the reflection of the light. When she caught sight of the ink marring it, she gasped and covered her mouth. I felt terribly sorry for her as she dried her eyes quickly against one sleeve. While she was reaching up to slide the door closed, I caught a glimpse of her mistress. I could see at once why Hatsumomo called Mameha Miss Perfect. Her face was a perfect oval, just like a doll, and as smooth and delicate-looking as a piece of china, even without her makeup. She walked toward the doorway, trying to peer into the stairwell, but the maid quickly rolled the door shut. The next morning after lessons, I came back to the Okiya to find that Mother, Granny, and Auntie were shut up in the formal reception room on the first floor. I felt certain they were talking about the kimono, and sure enough, the moment Hatsumomo came in from the street, one of the maids went to tell Mother, who came into the entrance hall and stopped Hatsumomo on her way up the stairs. "We had a little visit from Mameha and her maid this morning," she said.
"Oh, Mother, I know just what you're going to say. I feel terrible about the kimono. I tried to stop Chiyo before she put ink on it, but it was too late."
By now, Auntie had limped out into the hall.
"Now you listen to me, Hatsumomo," Mother said. "You don't really think anyone is empty-headed enough to believe your little story. I won't have this sort of behavior in the Okiya, even from you. I have great respect for Mameha. I don't want to hear of anything like this happening again. As for the kimono, someone has to pay for it. I don't know what happened last night, but there's no dispute about who was holding the brush. The maid saw the girl doing it. The girl will pay."
Now Granny came out from the reception room and called a maid to fetch the bamboo pole.
"Chiyo has enough debts," said Auntie. "I don't see why she should pay Hatsumomo's as well."
"We've talked about this enough," Granny said. "The girl should be beaten and made to repay the cost of the kimono, and that's that. Where's the bamboo pole?"
"I'll beat her myself," Auntie said.
"I won't have your joints flaring up again, Granny. Come along, Chiyo."
Auntie waited until the maid brought the pole, and then led me down to the courtyard.
"What have you done to Hatsumomo? She's bent on destroying you. There must be a reason, and I want to know what it is."
"I promise you, Auntie, she's treated me this way since I arrived. I don't know what I ever did to her."
"You must never trust her, not even if she tries to help you. Already she's burdened you with so much debt you may never work it off."
"I don't understand," I said, "about debt."
"Hatsumomo's little trick with that kimono is going to cost you more money than you've ever imagined in your life. That's what I mean about debt."
"But how will I pay?"
"When you begin working as a geisha, you'll pay the Okiya back for it, along with everything else you'll owe. Your meals and lessons. If you get sick, your doctor's fees. You owe the Okiya even for the money it costs to acquire you."
Throughout my months in Gion, I'd certainly imagined that money must have changed hands before Satsu and I were taken from our home, but I'd never imagined that I myself would have to repay it.
"If you want to ruin your life in Gion, there are dozens of ways to do it," Auntie said. "You can try to run away, or you can make yourself unpopular with your teachers so they won't give you the help you need. Or you can grow up to be an ugly woman like me." I wasn't such an unattractive girl when Granny bought me from my parents. But I didn't turn out well, and Granny's always hated me for it.
One time she beat me so badly for something I did that she broke one of my hips. That's when I stopped being a geisha, and that's the reason I'm going to do the job of beating you myself rather than letting Granny get her hands on you. She led me to the walkway and made me lie down on my stomach there. When the beating was over, she left me crying there. Soon I felt the walkway tremble under someone's footsteps and sat up to find Hatsumomo standing above me.
Chiyo, I would be ever so grateful if you'd get out of my way.
You promised to tell me where I could find my sister, Hatsumomo, I said to her.
Your sister is in a joroya called Tatsuyo, she told me, in the district of Miyagawa-cho, just south of Gion.
When she was done speaking, she gave me a little shove with her foot, and I stepped down out of her way. I'd never heard the word joroya before, so the very next evening, when Auntie dropped a sewing tray onto the floor of the entrance hall and asked my help cleaning it up, I asked her,
Auntie, what is a joroya?
It's the sort of place Hatsumomo will end up if she ever gets what she deserves, she said.
She didn't seem inclined to say more, so I had no choice but to leave it at that. My question certainly wasn't answered, but I did form the impression Satsu might be suffering even more than I was. So I began thinking about how I might sneak to this place called Tatsuyo the very next time I had an opportunity. Unfortunately, part of my punishment for ruining Mameha's kimono was confinement in the Okiya for 50 days. One evening, as I was waiting up for Hatsumomo, I heard the telephone ring, and a young woman named Yoko came out a moment later and went up the stairs. Yoko spent every day from mid-afternoon until late evening sitting by the telephone in our maid's room booking Hatsumomo's schedule. When she came back down, she was holding Hatsumomo's shamisen, a kind of Japanese guitar, disassembled in its lacquer carrying case.
"You'll have to take this to the Mizuki tea house," she said to me. "Hatsumomo has lost a bet and has to play a song on a shamisen."
Yoko apparently didn't know I was confined to the Okiya.
It seemed to me my chance to find my sister had come at last.
I heard thunder rumble overhead, and the air smelled of rain, so I hurried to the Mizuki tea house, one of the most exclusive in all of Japan. And a tea house isn't for tea, you see. It's the place where men go to be entertained by geisha. The moment I stepped into the entryway, the door before me rolled open. A young maid kneeling on the raised floor inside gazed down at me. She didn't say a word but just took the shamisen box from my arms.
Miss, I said, may I ask, can you tell me where the Miyagawa-cho district is?
She gave me a strange look, but then told me to walk along the river until I had passed the Minamiza Theater and I would find myself in Miyagawa-cho. Soon I found myself in an area without streetlights and nearly empty of people. The only illumination came from light bulbs in the open doorways where old women sat on stools, often with two or three women I took to be geisha on the street beside them. They wore kimono and hair ornaments similar to geisha, but their obi were tied in the front rather than the back. I'd never seen this before, and I didn't understand it, but it's the mark of a prostitute. A woman who must take her sash on and off all night can't be bothered with tying it behind her again and again. With the help of one of these women, I found the Tatsuyo in a dead-end alley with only three other houses. In the doorway of the Tatsuyo sat an old woman on a stool, carrying on a conversation with a much younger woman on a stool across the alley.
"Please, ma'am," I said, "do you have a girl here named Satsu?"
"We don't have any Satsu," she said.
"Yes, you do," said the younger woman across the way. "You're Yukio. Her name used to be Satsu, I remember."
"That's as may be," replied the old woman. "But we don't have any Satsu for this girl.
I don't get myself into trouble for nothing."
I didn't know what she meant by this until the woman muttered that I didn't look as if I had even a single sen on me. "If it's money you want," I said, "Satsu will pay you.
I'm her little sister. If you'd be kind enough to tell her Chiyo is here, she'll pay you what you want."
This must have been the right thing to say, because she turned to the younger woman across the alley.
"You go up for me. I'll stay here and keep an eye on this girl."
The younger woman stood up from her stool and walked across into the Tatsuyo. I heard her climbing the stairs inside. Finally, she came back down and said,
"Yukio has a customer. When he's done, someone will tell her to come down."
Finally, a man came out, picking at his teeth with a toothpick. And then I heard the most pleasing sound I'd heard since coming to Kyoto.
"You wanted me, ma'am?"
It was Satsu's voice. I sprang to my feet and rushed to see her standing in the doorway. Her skin looked pale, almost gray, though perhaps it was only because she wore a kimono of garish yellows and reds. I felt such relief at seeing her I could hardly keep from rushing into her arms. I followed her into the gloomy entrance hall of the Tatsuyo.
"Oh, Chiyo,"
she said, and then she reached up to scratch her face, or at least I thought she was scratching her face, for I couldn't see well. It took me a moment to understand she was crying. After this, I could do nothing to hold back my own tears.
"I'm so sorry, Satsu," I told her. "It's all my fault."
Somehow or other, we stumbled toward one another in the dark until we were hugging.
"Why did it take you so long?"
she whispered to me.
"I'm so sorry. I know you came to my Okiya. The woman you spoke with there is a monster. She wouldn't give me the message for the longest time."
"I have to run away, Chiyo. I can't stay here in this place any longer."
"I'll come with you."
"We'll go back home. I've been stealing money whenever I can. I have enough to pay off Mrs. Kishino. She gets beaten whenever a girl escapes. She won't let me go unless I pay her first."
"Mrs. Kishino? Who is she?"
"The old lady at the front door."
"You'd better go now. The mistress may be here at any moment. But wait, when do we run away?"
"We'll run away Tuesday, late at night, 5 days from now. I have to go upstairs, Chiyo. A man has come for me."
"But wait, Satsu, where will we meet? What time?"
"I don't know. 1 in the morning, but I don't know where."
I suggested we meet near the Minamiza Theater, but Satsu thought it would be too easy for people to find us. We agreed to meet at a spot exactly across the river from it.
"I have to go now," she said. "But Satsu, what if I can't get away, or what if we don't meet up? Just be there, Chiyo. I'll have only one chance."
Every night, I lay on my futon scheming. But as late as the very day before Satsu and I had arranged to run away, I'd come up with no plan for my escape. I spent a long while Monday afternoon pretending to weed the courtyard while really only squatting on the stones and brooding. Then one of the maids gave me the job of washing the wood floor in the maid's room where Yoko was seated beside the telephone, and something extraordinary happened. I squeezed a rag full of water onto the floor, but instead of snaking along toward the doorway as I would have expected, it ran toward one of the corners of the room.
"Yoko, look," I said. "The water's running uphill."
Of course, it wasn't really uphill. It only looked that way to me. I was so startled by this that I squeezed more water and watched it run into the corner again. And then, well, I can't say exactly how it happened, but I pictured myself flowing up the stairs to the second floor landing, and from there up the ladder, through the trap door and onto the roof beside the gravity feed tank. The roof! I was so astonished at the thought, I forgot my surroundings completely. And when the telephone beside Yoko rang, I almost cried out in alarm. I wasn't sure what I would do once I reached the roof,
But if I could succeed in finding my way down from there, I might meet Satsu after all. The following evening, I made a great show of yawning when I went to bed and threw myself onto my futon as though I were a sack of rice. At length, the maids settled down onto their futons beside me on the floor. I sat up as quietly as I could. A robe for me to wear on the following morning lay folded on the floor nearby. I took it in my arms and went straight for the stairwell, taking the shoes reserved for use in the upstairs toilet. After closing the trapdoor silently behind me, I stuffed my sleeping robe under the gravity feed tank and managed to climb up and straddle my legs over the ridge of the roof. I put my shoes onto my hands to keep from dropping them and began scooting my way along the ridge, which proved to be more difficult than I'd imagined. I took several minutes to cross just to the other side of our okiya. The roof of the building next door was a step lower than ours. I climbed down onto it and stopped a moment to look for a path to the street, but despite the moonlight, I could see only a sheet of blackness. I continued along from ridge to ridge until I found myself near the end of the block, looking down on one side into an open courtyard. If I could make my way to the gutter, I could scoot around it until I came to what seemed to be a bath shed. From the top of the bath shed, I could climb down into the courtyard easily. I swung my leg over so that in a moment I was dangling along the slope of the roof, just barely clinging to the ridge. I realized with some panic that it was much steeper than I'd thought it would be. I tried to scamper back up, but I couldn't do it. I heard myself skidding with a hissing sound, and then suddenly the roof was no longer there. I turned as I fell and landed on my side on the ground. I had the sense to bring an arm up to protect my head, but still I landed so heavily that I knocked myself into a daze. Slowly, I became aware of two women kneeling over me. One kept saying something again and again, but I couldn't make it out. All I could do was lie there thinking about how Satsu would be waiting for me opposite the Minamiza Theater and I would never show up. The maid was sent up the street to knock on doors until she found where I'd come from. Suddenly I felt myself pulled to my feet and slapped across the face. "Foolish, foolish girl," said a voice. Auntie was standing before me in a rage, and then pulled me out of that okiya and behind her up the street. As it turned out, I'd broken my arm landing as I had in that courtyard. The next morning, a doctor came and took me to a clinic nearby. It was late afternoon already by the time I was brought back to the okiya with a plaster cast on my arm. I was still in terrible pain, but Mother called me immediately to her room.
"Do you know how much I paid for you?" she said to me.
"No, ma'am," I answered. "But you're going to tell me you paid more than I'm worth."
"I paid 75 yen for you. That's what I paid. Then you went and ruined a kimono, and now you've broken your arm, so I'll be adding medical expenses to your debts as well. Plus you have your meals and lessons, and just this morning I heard from the mistress of the Tatsuyo over in Miyagawa-cho that your older sister has run away. The mistress there still hasn't paid me what she owes. Now she tells me she's not going to do it. I'll add that to your debt as well. But what difference will it make? You already owe more than you'll ever repay."
So Satsu had escaped. I'd spent the day wondering, and now I had my answer. I wanted to feel happy for her, but I couldn't.
"I suppose you could repay it after 10 or 15 years as a geisha," she went on, "if you happen to be a success. But who would invest another sen in a girl who runs away?"
With this, she ordered me out of the room. When spring came, the cherry trees blossomed in Maruyama Park, and no one in Kyoto seemed to talk about anything else. One morning, as Mother and Auntie were preparing to take Granny on a picnic, I came down the stairs to find a package on the floor of the front entrance hall. It was a box about as long as my arm, wrapped in heavy paper and tied up with frayed twine. I went over to read the name and address in heavy characters on the face. It said, Sakamoto Chiyo. The return address, beneath a patch of stamps, was from Mr. Tanaka. Before I could figure out what to do next, Auntie came down the